The government shutdown has put a major strain on immigration courts. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Miami already has one of the busiest immigration courts in the country with a growing backlog. The shutdown now means people waiting for working visas and green cards are left waiting longer. We'll learn how some of those people could be waiting for years, even after the shutdown ends. Also, there's a fight in Key West that's getting national attention. City officials will decide if they should ban the sale of a specific sunscreen because of chemicals that may be destructive to ocean life. We'll talk to City Commissioner Samuel Kaufman about the upcoming vote and about the other big fight in the city, pop-up cosmetic shops. Finally, Coconut Grove resident Michael Langlois spent years with the Great American Ballet Theater. He shares his stories, including working with the legend Mikhail Baryshnikov. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, coming up, we're going to discuss the story of the 2014 murder in Miami-Dade of a rabbi, and it received national attention, and that case remains unsolved. But first, let's start with a partial government shutdown and how it's impacting another sector of our society, immigration courts. Because of the shutdown, cases of immigrants looking for work visas or green cards have now been put on hold. Now, Miami-Dade's immigration courts is already one of the busiest in the nation, and it has a massive backlog of cases. Now, we talked with the Miami Herald's David Ovalle earlier today to better understand what's happening at the courts, and he joined us from the WLRN studios at the Miami Herald in Doral.
Well, the immigration court here in Miami is among the busiest. I mean, obviously, we are a hub of the immigration courts, and it's, you know, obviously the volume is just insane here. I mean, obviously we're getting people from all over Latin America that are coming here to Miami, and their cases are adjudicated here, and they're detained here, and it's an incredibly backlogged jurisdiction of the courts.
And I think I'd read in your story it was like over 60,000 cases.
In Florida, yeah, in Florida, yes.
Okay.
60,000, yeah.
Do we have any idea how many judges are in this in the immigration court here in South Florida?
I don't recall off the top of my head how many there are, but it's safe to say that there's not nearly enough in Florida and across the country. And with that, they've actually increased the number of judges, but it's just simply not enough to keep up with the amount of cases that are coming in, especially under this administration.
I'm just trying to figure out, like, how, on average, how long does it take to get through one case? How fast can they get through these?
Well, it obviously depends on the type of case. There's, you know, myriad of different cases. But, for example, you are fighting to stay in this country and you have a waiver. Let's say you there's a deportation order against you, but you have a waiver. Let's say you were convicted of something and you might be able to get some sort of relief from it. I mean, it could take, you know, years. I mean, the young man I profiled in my story, he's been waiting, you know, 4 or 5 years to try to get his case figured out. And he had sort of the last hearing set and he was going to be able to stay. And but then the shutdown happened. And
now how long is he going to have to wait?
It's really unclear how long a lot of these people are going to have to wait to get their cases reset, because there's only so many spaces and slots that can be filled on any given court docket. So either a case that's already set is going to have to be moved, or it's going to get bumped to the back of the line. So when the shutdown finally is over with, that does not mean that everything just goes back to normal, because now you have to spend a lot of time and resources ironing out the backlog and just trying to figure out how to put the pieces back together again. So it's going to be confusion. It's going to be a mess for a long time.
And what happens to him now?
Well, you know, for example, this young man I interviewed, he had been hoping to be able to get his ID and his all his proper paperwork so he could go back to school and eventually join the military. But all of that's on hold until he's able to get this done. So as of right now, he's pretty much not doing anything, just living with his family.
What's happening to immigrants who, for example, have been detained? What's happening to them as they wait?
Well, so there's two different types of hearings. There's the detention hearings, which are still going on, and all the people that are working in those hearings. So if you're an undocumented immigrant and you get picked up by ICE and you're sent to the Chrome Detention Center here in Miami, there are still detention hearings that are still going on. But the judges, the court staff, all the people involved in security, they are not getting paid. They will get paid eventually once the government is put back into effect. But they're being, working without any sort of compensation right now. But it has affected things in those detention hearings, right? Those are held at Chrome for people who are still in custody. A lot of the lawyers have told me that there's been delays. There hasn't been enough court staff to security staff because people have been calling in sick to get these cases moving. So there's been a lot of delays, and it's just sort of the logistical things you would expect when there's a government shutdown.
And then, like those folks you had just mentioned and that you had talked about in your story, if they're waiting for a green card, a work visa, they're just pretty much left on hold. And as they're waiting, they may not be able to do anything.
They may not be able to do anything. And there's a real dread. There's real anxiety among some of these people because they are terrified that they are just going to get deported, and even if the government shut down and their hearing, gets canceled. So I interviewed one lawyer who had a client who was told that the government, that the hearing had been canceled, but he was so terrified that he drove 2 hours to go to the courthouse on the day of the hearing just to be sure that it was indeed canceled, because he was afraid that if he didn't show up and it went through, then suddenly he would be, they would use that as an excuse to deport him. So it's created a lot of just logistical problems and anxiety among people who are already dealing with anxious situations.
And then you have folks who are trying to get into the country, and they're waiting to be processed. And what's happening with them?
Well, those determinations aren't made necessarily in the immigration courts. Those would be made with, State Department and other people who are doing the visas and all of that. But yes, it's absolutely caused a lot of issues with just those types of things that we don't really hear and see very often. Even, for example, another genre that I didn't sort of vein of this that I didn't write about in the story is the business visas. People who are development, like they're investing money here, and they can get visas by investing money in real estate developments, for example, hotels, high-rise condos, things, people from Latin America that have a lot of money and are able to invest here, but they can't get their things processed, their visas processed, because of these shutdowns. So it's created a lot of just headaches.
We're talking with the Miami Herald's David Ovalle. We've been discussing how the partial government shutdown is hurting people who are on the waiting list at immigration court. Let's shift gears now. I want to talk about an important criminal case here in Miami-Dade. It's about the 2014 murder of Rabbi Joseph Raxon. The young man charged with this murder was DeAndre Charles. But after a year in prison, prosecutors dropped those charges, and Charles is now suing. David, let's go back over this case real quickly. Rabbi Raxon was gunned down. He was walking in a northeast neighborhood here in Miami-Dade. Remind us quickly what happened.
Well, he was approached by a couple young men. There was sort of a tussle, and Rabbi Raxon was shot and killed. And this, he was visiting from New York, and this was a huge case, a very, very shocking case, especially in the Orthodox Jewish community here in Northeast Dade. So it was a huge deal, and it made news all over the country. And so this was a high-pressure investigation for the police department.
And it took a while for law enforcement to make an arrest.
Yeah, it took over a year for there to be an arrest. And when there was an arrest, it was a circumstantial case that on the face of it, at least, when they first presented it to the media and to the public, it seemed like it was a pretty strong circumstantial case. But it took, many months, and sort of the case just kept getting weaker and weaker until all the holes were exposed, and they ended up having to drop the charges against the only person that was arrested, which at the time was a 15-year-old teenager named DeAndre Charles.
And, one of the things that made it, of course, as you said, this was a story because of it, it happened in the Orthodox Jewish community. It made national news. But then one of the things that happened when they finally were charging Charles is when State Attorney Catherine Fernandez-Rundle got up in front of the press and then showed off the drawing of the killer made by eyewitnesses. And that became the butt of a lot of jokes on television. Why is that?
Well, the case was not built on that sketch.
Right.
It was just the key eyewitness who identified DeAndre Charles as the person running away from the shooting, went into court and testified to that, made that drawing as just sort of a thing to help the police. And it was a crude drawing. It was sort of a comical thing that made its way on the internet and, you know, on sort of the late night circuit. But the indelible image that people remember is the state attorney holding up that thing. And it was sort of cast, I think BuzzFeed or somebody called it the worst police sketch ever, which was inaccurate because it wasn't a police sketch. That sort of became the butt of all jokes, and it ended up appearing in the lawsuit, the wrongful arrest lawsuit.
Did she ever say why she even held it up? Why put yourself in that situation?
No, I mean, it was just a demonstrative aid that they were using at the press conference, but that's just sort of the thing that most people remember from that press conference.
So what was the concrete evidence they say they had on DeAndre Charles?
So at the time, it was a circumstantial case. They believed that they had DNA evidence that put him in a vehicle that was used at the scene, and also the gun that was used in the shooting. They had cell phone records that placed him at the scene. And they had the eyewitness testimony, which was, you know, the neighbor who saw him, or who he believed was DeAndre Charles, running from the shooting.
And he spent a year in jail, and then they dropped the charges. Why?
Well, a couple things. They ended up getting some evidence that the gun used in the shooting was used in another robbery. And whoever that person had been robbed could not identify who the robber was. I'm sorry. Also, the DNA reporting methods had changed, and so there was no longer completely certain that was his DNA on the gun that was used. Whether he had been in the car or not was not really an issue, because he had been stopped in the car amongst a bunch of other teenagers, young men, a few days after. His lawyer said he was just going for a joyride with some of his older brother's associates. And sort of the main thing was there was all these people that were in this car kind of blamed each other for the shooting, and there was sort of all these conflicting accounts of who was there, what happened, and so none of those people ever got charged. So there was a lot of sort of inconsistent statements and accounts of what happened, and it's just the prosecutors never said that they thought DeAndre Charles was innocent, but they did not have enough to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the criminal case, so it got dropped.
The case still open?
The case is still considered open. Miami-Dade homicide is still, it's still technically on the books as an unsolved case. That has not stopped the lawyers from filing a federal lawsuit, saying that DeAndre Charles was wrongfully arrested.
Yeah, and part of that lawsuit, I mean, what basically that he was wrongly arrested, and what else? What else is in the claim in the lawsuit?
Well, they're claiming that Miami-Dade police rushed a judgment to they were hellbent on solving this high profile case because of the nature of a rabbi getting shot, and also that having this press conference was in essence a mocking perp walk of sorts, and having that cartoonish sketch on full display really harmed his reputation, and he's forever on the internet as the guy who supposedly killed a rabbi, and that they ignored the evidence that they made the arrest despite the evidence that there was all these other young men that were somehow involved. So and it's not unusual for people in these types of things to file a wrongful death, wrongful arrest lawsuit. So it'll be interesting to see how it all shakes out.
Have we heard from the police department or the state attorney's office?
No, they generally do not comment on ongoing litigation. So it'll all play out in depositions and court hearings and court filings. And, you know, they'll try to prove that they made this arrest in good faith with probable cause. And then we'll see what happens from there.
And I do want to mention, too, that we have reached out to try to speak with State Attorney Catherine Fernandez-Rundle on this case. Again, talking with the Miami Herald's David Ovalle about one big murder case that's still open. And also, we talked about the immigration courts here in South Florida and how the partial government shutdown is impacting the court system. David, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And you can find more information about the criminal case involving DeAndre Charles, as well as the impact of the partial government shutdown on immigration courts, by going to our website, WLRN.org. Well, still to come, there are two fights going on in Key West over cosmetic sales and sunscreen. The debate has made national news. That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. There are two controversial fights happening right now in Key West. The first is one that has received national attention. It's about sunscreen. The city recently voted to become the first municipality in the country to ban certain types of sunscreen, specifically those with chemicals like oxybenzone and octinoxate that environmental groups say are harmful to coral reefs. And the second issue is about pop-up cosmetic shops. These are shops on the popular tourist location Duval Street that have employees on the street trying to get customers' attention by offering free samples and then to lure them into the store. There have also been complaints of customer credit card charges. Key Westers have been angrily complaining that these shops end up overcharging tourists. Jim Sherrington of Key West said on Facebook, maybe rein in the cosmetic shop employees who make it uncomfortable to walk down Duval Street. Sue Huffaker said the city should refuse to renew the licenses on the existing shops and refuse them to any proposed new shops. Now, other residents of Key West have even organized a response team that protests in front of the store so that tourists know not to go in. Today, we're talking with Key West District 2 Commissioner Samuel Kaufman about both of these issues, and he joins us from the Key West studios in our southernmost bureau. Commissioner Kaufman, it's such a pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for having me.
I also do want to mention that if you live in Key West, we'd love to hear from you. What do you think about these issues? What do you think about the ban on certain sunscreens? Should we legislate that out? And are you convinced of the science? Also, I want to hear from you about the cosmetic shops. If you live or work in that area, tell us about the shops and how you feel about their business practices. Is it just doing business, or do you think that they should go? 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Commissioner Kaufman, let's start with the sunscreen. What are the details of the recent vote and what the commission wants to do about, again, not all sunscreen, the sunscreens that have these two particular chemicals?
Right. So the ordinance, which the city commission has passed upon first reading in Key West, ordinances require two different votes over two separate city commission meetings. And in the first reading, what was approved by the board was basically a one-year period when local retailers could transition and eliminate having the so-called sunscreens that are not ocean safe or reef safe. And there are already, you know, plenty of products that, including major industry retailers provided by, say, Johnson & Johnson, that provide so-called ocean or reef safe products, sunscreens. So the ordinance right now, as it stands, would give a one-year period when retailers would be able to transition within the city limits to eliminate these products with these two chemicals.
And as mentioned, so the measure passed 7-0 the first time that the commission looked at it. It has to review it again a second time. What are the details that have to be reviewed again? What's going to be discussed that second vote?
Well, you know, I can only speak for myself. I don't know what the other six members of the city commission are doing or thinking, but our next meeting is on February 5th at 6 p.m. at City Hall. And I know from my perspective, I would like to see some compromise reached and some modifications to the current proposed ordinance. For example, I would like to see that the time frame be changed for the implementation of the ban to be concurrent with the state of Hawaii. As you know, the state of Hawaii has already banned these products to begin in the year 2021. And that would give us time really to see what additional UV filters that are being developed, different sunscreens that are being developed by the industry that do not contain these chemicals, to see what the FDA does in the interim the next 2 years in terms of providing alternatives. Because there are legitimate concerns that we have in our community from residents who say, you know, I want to have access to my sunscreen with these chemicals because there's a belief that they're stronger products, that they adhere better to skin, and they provide more protection against skin cancer.
Again, the number is 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Find us on social media, WLRN Sundial. Whether you live in the Keys, actually, or even if you visit, how do you feel about this issue, the issue of legislating out certain products because maybe they are not environmentally safe? We'd like to hear your thoughts. We are going to also talk about the pop-up cosmetic shops on Duval Street. And if you have any comments or questions about that, we'd also love to hear from you. 800-743-9576. Commissioner, you know, when we talk about the science behind it, you guys have talked to local reef experts about these ingredients, understanding what those effects are?
We have over two meetings. We had a meeting in December and one, as you know, January 15th in City Hall at City Commission meetings. And we've been presented with a lot of science, scientific information from experts. We've heard from dermatologists that are very concerned. We've heard from scientists on both sides of the debate. Quite frankly, from my perspective, in terms of preserving our reef, which is such an important thing for our local economy to preserve this for generations to come, sunscreen is just one part of the mix here. We need to look at a more comprehensive approach in terms of the science. We need to understand how the water quality issues, the runoff of chemicals from the Everglades, perhaps the overuse from local tour operators that are bringing hundreds of people a day to the reef, how that's having impact on the reef. We really need to look at this at a much higher level to really understand how we can best preserve the reef. And sunscreen, of course, is one aspect of that.
You know what, to remind people too, with the coral reefs, what their impact on the economy in Key West, especially for tourism.
Yeah, we have people that come to Key West just to snorkel and dive the reef. We have an entire economy that is based upon our marine environment, the fishing. The fishing, for those of you on the mainland that don't know, you need to come to Key West and fish. We have amazing fishing here, and I love to fish. And, you know, it's vitally important that we protect the reef, the marine life, and we want to, you know, I believe that the city leaders want to protect the reef, but we also want to be responsive and to the concerns about skin cancer. And I'm hoping that we can achieve a balance here, and I think we can with some compromise.
800-743-9576, your thoughts on banning a certain type of sunscreen because the chemicals may be environmentally hazardous to the coral reefs, to other fish life. Or also, again, if you have any comments about these cosmetic shops on Duval Street, 800-743-9576. Let me go to the phones. I'm going to get Randy in Key West. Randy, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Randy. We can hear you.
Hey, Mr. Kaufman. It's Randy Pekarek. How are you?
Hey, good. Good to hear from you, Randy.
Good. Listen, I really firmly believe that we need to move forward with the ban on the toxic chemicals and the sunscreen. As you know, I'm a part-time scuba instructor on the weekends, and I've just seen terrible destruction to the coral reefs in the last 20 years. And the reefs really need every chance we can give them to come back. And as you stated, I mean, our economy is based on tourism and fishing, you know, and diving. And if we don't protect the reefs and give them a chance to regrow and come back, I mean, we're not going to have anything. I think the science is there. There's other countries besides the state of Hawaii that have already put this ban in place. I don't see any reason for us to linger, to drag our feet, so to speak, as to implementing this ban. There's other methods to protect people, such as protective clothing and other sunscreens that are currently available.
And Randy, if I may real quickly, how long have you been a scuba instructor out there?
I've been an instructor for about 15 years, last 15 years. I've been scuba diving since 1975.
And so you've seen the change in the coral reefs?
Firsthand. It makes me want to cry when I go diving on the reef to see the death and destruction that's out there.
Randy, I really appreciate the call. Thank you so much for sharing. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thanks.
You know what, speaking of that, because you also talked about, Commissioner, you talked about that last vote, and there were people who, well, they were kind of concerned. There were dermatologists who protested in front of City Hall at the time of the vote, saying that they were concerned that this ban on certain sunscreens could be potentially dangerous for people because of skin cancer rates. Is this something that has been discussed with the City Commission? What do you take, your take on their argument?
And I take it very seriously. I have had close relatives with skin cancer and cancer in my family, and I understand the importance of having all available products and procedures at our hands to be able to treat cancer and skin cancer. This is why, you know, if you think about it, you know, Key West is a small place. This Key West will be the first place to ban these two chemicals in sunscreens. And it's anticipated that this will spread throughout the state of Florida and other places. And it's going to take time for the implementation of this ban. So I think that we can accomplish a balance and a compromise and allow the industry to produce additional sunscreen products that are ocean safe, and to allow us also time to address the other causes in terms of why the reef is declining. We need to address all of them, not just sunscreen. We have to address the water quality issues, as I said, and the economic problems of overpopulating the reef with tourists on a daily basis. We need to do all these things because I agree with Randy. The reef is extremely important.
When's the final vote, and how do you plan on voting?
It's February 5th, 6 p.m. at City Hall. I plan on voting in favor, but like I said, with these additional amendments and modifications to the proposed ordinance to allow it to be concurrent with the state of Hawaii, and for us to be able to have more input from the industry and scientists in terms of the efficacy of alternative sunscreens and the impact that these sunscreens have on the reef.
We're talking with Key West Commissioner Samuel Kaufman of District 2. We're talking about two issues here. We've been talking about the vote that's coming up in February, as he mentioned, on sunscreen. Certain sunscreens with specific chemicals in them that could be harmful to the reefs and other sea life. And the first vote came out 7-0 in looking not on the ban, but also just the ban, but also, you know, what are the alternatives in helping companies to find those alternatives so that they can move past those chemicals. We want to move now to the issue of these pop-up cosmetic shops on Duval Street. And if you live or work in that area, you know what they are. Again, you have people standing out in the street, giving out free samples, trying to lure you into the store. But there have been questions about, are these stores were acting legally? There have been stories of overcharging, especially tourists. And is this harmful to business on Duval Street? We'd love to hear from you on any of these issues. 800-743-9576. Commissioner Kaufman, first explain this issue with the cosmetic shops on Duval Street. What exactly are they doing that's illegal?
Well, first of all, I want your listeners to know that Key West is an absolutely great place to visit, and not to get the wrong impression, you know, that there are all these unscrupulous store owners and so on.
No, of course. And tourist towns have all these issues all the time. So just to point out.
Right. So, so there have been complaints over the last several years concerning stores that are selling the so-called Dead Sea products, skincare products. And there have been complaints over the years of failures on the part of the store owners to provide refunds. I haven't heard that the refunds, failure to provide refunds has been an issue lately or recently. I haven't heard that. But there certainly is the concern that's been raised by the local protest group and plenty of local residents that are concerned about the employees of these stores that stand outside their stores and may be aggressive in terms of speaking with passersby and so on.
And, you know, you talk about, you know, some people in Key West, they have responded and really taken matters in their own hands. And one group particularly is called the Rapid Response Ripoff Team. And this is a group of people that will stand in front of shops picketing. And they're basically telling the owners, look, there's an agreement we want you to sign. Stop doing certain things. What do you think about this group? I mean, what do you think about citizens taking things into their own hands?
Well, generally speaking, I'm in favor of that. I guess the concern I have is I've heard from neighboring stores that are not selling cosmetic products that are being hurt, and they're innocent bystanders in all of this. So that does raise a concern to me. I'm concerned a little bit about, I'm not sure how familiar you are, your listeners are about Duval Street, but the sidewalk is not a very wide sidewalk. And, you have, many people who are protesting. And we had one incident of a physical altercation, and so that sort of thing concerns me. I don't think there's any place for violence or physical altercations in any of this protest activity. So overall, I think it's a good thing for residents and concerned people to raise these types of issues. Nobody would support, and no one supports any stores ripping off tourists or locals or harassing people.
But do you
think bringing attention to this is overall a good thing?
But do you think that that basically we have to legislate how business is done to make sure that, because Duval Street, as you said, I mean that it's the main thoroughfare for tourists, and like when you think of other tourist cities, there's that one spot. This is where people go, and it's important to your tourist economy. And if in any way it gets hurt, that's a big hit to the economy. Do you think you have to protect it by just making a lot of rules so that?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I don't think legislation is the ultimate answer. I think that the landlords and the store owners on Duval Street need to take the responsibility ultimately to transform Duval Street into what it needs to become, and make it a showcase street. Our main street, where visitors and locals can enjoy and feel safe and have a fantastic time. I know that there are many landlords who are addressing this now, and there's an effort to negotiate with these stores and with the protest group. And I'm very hopeful that there will be compromise reached, and there will be rules that they all will agree to. The landlords have the most interest here, because they have tenants, and they want their tenants to remain in place, and they want to make sure that the rules are being abided by their tenants.
Let me jump in real quick here with the short time that I have. I want to go back to the phones real quickly. Robert in Miami, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Go ahead.
So my question was this. So if we ban the chemicals that we're using now in these sunscreens, that's great to protect the reefs and everything, but what are the steps that we're going to be taking to ensure that the future products that are made aren't even more harmful than what we already have on the shelf?
Well, Robert, thank you for the call. Yeah, no,
just bravo to the citizens of Key West for what they're doing to protect their tourists from these traps.
Robert, thank you for the call. Just real briefly, Commissioner, in the short time that I have, it's like, again, you're looking to make sure that you give the companies time to make the adjustments, but how do you protect from future problems?
Well, for example, Johnson & Johnson, they already produce an array of ocean, what's accepted as ocean-safe products. So we just need to know that the products that are advertised, branded ocean-safe or reef-safe, that they actually are ocean-safe or reef-safe, and that they're effective sunscreens. And that's really what I'm talking about, is that we need to know that those citizens that are concerned about the efficacy of these sunscreens, that those concerns are addressed, and that, in fact, not only the sunscreens, but all these other issues that are affecting the decline of the reef are addressed.
And I'll have to end it there. Key West Commissioner Samuel Kaufman of District 2 joining us from the studios of Key West. Commissioner Kaufman, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
All right, still to come, what's it like working with a genius? One South Florida man shares his time with American Ballet Theater and the time he spent with Mikhail Baryshnikov. That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, I'm going to turn the conversation over now to our Morning Edition anchor, Christine DiMatte, who recently spoke with a longtime dancer with the American Ballet Theater, Michael Langlois, who's out with a new book now.
Ask most ballet dancers who Mr. B was, and they'll have a ready answer. George Balanchine. The legendary Russia-born choreographer and ballet master is credited with changing the face of American dance. In the 1980s, another Mr. B was forging his own legacy in the art. It was dancer Mikhail Baryshnikov, who for 10 years served as artistic director for the American Ballet Theater. In the hierarchy of most major dance companies, below the principal dancers and soloists, are members of the corps de ballet. Their job is to basically dance their hearts out in the rehearsal studio and on stage, all the while living in hopes of graduating from the role of peasant or shepherdess to prince or swan queen. Michael Langlois knows all about it. He spent 6 years as a member of ABT in the 1980s. His new book is titled B+, Dancing for Mikhail Baryshnikov at American Ballet Theater. He's a longtime Coconut Grove resident working now as a massage therapist. He will be sharing stories from his new book at Books and Books in Coral Gables this Thursday. First, as a kid, you did all kinds of sports, but wanted to be a football player. So tell us how you ended up as a dancer instead.
Well, in the late 60s, there were some football players, professional players, that became noteworthy for taking ballet classes. I mean, you can imagine football players taking a ballet class was something news organizations jumped on. And so there was a broadcast on the evening news one night, and I had already been following football pretty avidly as a little kid. You know, I loved all kinds of sports, and I'd been writing letters to all these football players that I loved. And so I saw this news broadcast, and I said to my mom, that looks like something I should do. Maybe it will make me a better football player. So she went off and found me a teacher. This was in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Where were you raised? It sounds like you were raised half between Andover and Winston-Salem.
Yeah. My dad was in the service when I was born in California, but he took a job with Western Electric, and then we moved about every 4 years when I was growing up. So the earliest memories I have are of Salt Lake City and then North Carolina, Winston-Salem. Then we moved up north to Andover for 4 years and then back to North Carolina. So I was moving around quite a bit as a kid.
In your book, there's really no Billy Elliot moment where you stumble into a class of little ballerinas wearing their tutus and you've got your boxing shoes on and you start just, you know, impulsively doing pliés. What was ballet class like when you were a kid starting out?
Well, it was unusual because I started with two boys and a male teacher, which, as you say, is very unusual. Most boys enter a class with all girls. So, I mean, the teacher that my mom found for me was a pretty unusual man. He had never been a dancer. He fell in love with dance, and he decided to become a teacher. And he had this small school in a little shopping mall, and he'd studied the Vaganova system, which was a system of teaching that came about in Russia in the early part of the 20th century. And that was pretty much how he taught. These classes are all written down in books. And you can actually teach classes from that era if you follow them closely enough. Anyway, so he had a couple of boys as students who were also football players and were my age, strangely enough. And when my mom found him, my mom was pretty savvy, even though she didn't know a lot about ballet and had never really danced herself. She was just a really shrewd woman who I think knew quality when she saw it. And I think she could see that this man was no fool and he knew what he was doing. So she said, look, you want to study ballet? Here's a guy that I found. He has these two boys who were brothers, also football players. And so I went the first day, and I was just me and him. There were no other students, and he just started describing the positions to me, and he taught me this class all by myself, and I found it wasn't something that I loved. It took me a long, long time to fall in love with ballet, and that may sound surprising because most people will tell you, girls especially, you know, that they fall in love with it from the beginning. But it took me a long time. I would say probably my second or third year that I was in ballet theater, I really started to feel a real love for dancing.
What age, first off, did you start?
10.
You were a public school student, so things were pretty hard. You had homophobic slurs flung at you by the
right.
other kids. And in the book, you talk about what it's like to be a heterosexual dancer surrounded night and day by these beautiful girls.
That was the appealing part of it, obviously. If you're a straight boy and you're surrounded by a lot of beautiful girls, it's pretty wonderful. But the teasing that didn't start immediately. I mean, when I was 10, I was starting to play football. So because I was a really good athlete, I'd been a really good swimmer and a good diver. And my friends respected me because I was a good football player. And so those first few years that I was studying dance and still playing football, I still got a fair amount of respect from my friends. They were curious about my ballet training. Obviously, they didn't know anything about it. But because I was such a good player, they kind of left me alone about it. And so things didn't really turn south for me until I was 13, and my teachers in Boston at the time really forced me to decide between football and dance.
In your memoir, you write, quote, "I sometimes think that had my childhood been more tragic, I might have had more success as a dancer." It's as if you're saying that one has to really suffer to truly be a great artist. Did you really feel that way? Do you really feel that way now?
Well, I guess it's a sort of a cliche, isn't it? I think if you look at some of the greatest dancers, if you look at Misha Baryshnikov, my boss that I write about in the book, he suffered a tremendous tragedy in his life, and so did many other people. I don't think it's necessary, really, honestly. I mean,
what kind of tragedies did Baryshnikov suffer in his youth?
Well, his mother committed suicide when he was 12, and then his father subsequently remarried, and his father was pretty indifferent to him. And so Misha began spending most of his time away from his family. And then when he was 16, he left Riga and went to St. Petersburg to dance at the Kirov School with Pushkin, who became his teacher, who was his teacher. So he left home very young and felt pretty ostracized by his family. And then Pushkin subsequently died of a heart attack. And that left Misha kind of alone. And then he defected in 74. So there was a lot of loss in his life. Whether or not that made him a great dancer, I don't know. But I think something was fueling him. And something fuels every dancer, I think. In my own case, to some extent, it follows the Billy Elliot story a little bit, in as much as I wasn't sure about how my father felt about me as a young kid. And I just wanted to excel at something. It just happened to be ballet.
Let's talk about Baryshnikov. I notice you call him Misha. Mm-hmm. Does anybody call him by his actual given first name?
Probably interviewers call him Mikhail. I don't. Yeah, I mean, no. No one who knows him calls him Mikhail. We always called him Misha.
For those who don't know, describe the significance of Baryshnikov in that era.
Well, he was the most famous dancer on the planet, and famous not just for his dancing, but for his acting. I mean, like I said, I think, you know, the fact that he did The Turning Point really made him a household name. People knew about Misha to some extent because he defected in 74, and that was a pretty big story at the time. But I think to really bring ballet into people's conversations, it took something like a major motion picture to do it.
I'm speaking with former dancer Michael Langlois about his new book. It's titled B+, Dancing for Mikhail Baryshnikov at American Ballet Theater. In the book, you write that you pretty much determined at a young age that you'd never be an A dancer. Not a B, but a B+. How did you make that assessment?
When I got to New York, after leaving the North Carolina School of the Arts, where, you know, I was one of a very few boys in the high school dance program. You arrive in New York, you're suddenly confronted by, 35 of the most talented teenage boys in the country. So, of course, you look around and you start trying to figure out where you stand in relationship to those boys. And I had a pretty big ego, obviously. So I like to think that I was, better than these boys. But, you kind of, over time, you see boys doing things and you're like, I don't know if I can do that, but I can do this. There were certain technical benchmarks that were important.
Like?
Like turning. Okay.
Pirouette.
The ability to do pirouettes. So okay. Most people who go to the ballet, occasionally you will see, at Miami City Ballet, for example, you'll see dancers pulling off 7 pirouettes on stage. Not uncommon.
And you could do how many?
I could do 4 consistently. On good days, I could do 5, 6, occasionally 7 or 8. I think I realized that I wanted to be able to do 4 pirouettes at the drop of a hat, right and left. So I just would practice 4 all the time.
In an art that traditionally has demanded that its female artists be as light as air, it's not surprising to find body image problems and eating disorders among ballerinas. But in your book, you make it abundantly clear that this afflicts male dancers too. What did your own anorexia nervosa look like and feel like?
It felt like a prison that you really can't get out of. I mean, it's a prison of your own making. You know, you make decisions about what you're not going to eat.
But there were other dancers experiencing the same thing. So Was it this brotherhood and sisterhood of people just ignoring the problem, or did the other dancers help you through this?
No, it's more the former. It's something that is largely unspoken or completely unspoken. It exists really under the radar in ballet, in the ballet world, in companies. Nowadays companies are well aware of it, and they make big efforts to, you know, stem the tide of eating disorders. But you just can't know what dancers are doing in private. You can't go home with them and see what they're eating or not eating, or whether they're eating and throwing up.
How'd you overcome it?
Well, at a certain point, you just get tired of being miserable. You know, there's only so much of misery you can inflict on yourself. And then I think as my interest in dance started to wane, that kind of compulsion sort of went with it, because the two kind of went hand in hand a little bit. The drive and the desire and the need to, or the desire to look a certain way. So it came about slowly. You know, at the end of my career, I realized how unhappy I was. I started going to therapy and talking about it and, you know, trying to figure out how to eat lunch and not hate yourself. That's a big hurdle.
New York City figures so prominently in your dance life and in the lives of so many other dancers. What brought you to Miami?
The weather.
Ah.
Yeah.
Hear that
well,
a lot.
Like many people. We toured here a lot. I mean, I'm sure people that live in Miami will know. Ballet Theater used to come here. Judy Drucker, you know, was instrumental in that and brought the company here every year during the 80s. We danced at the Jackie Gleason. She would bring great singers and ballet dancers. She brought a lot of culture to Miami at a time when there wasn't a lot here. She was a force. And I remember, you know, she was always thrilled to have Misha and Ballet Theater come. And we'd spent 2 weeks here at the Jackie Gleason every January. And so I knew Miami from those days when it was not what it is now, obviously. And after living for 13 years in New York and 10 years in Boston, I really had enough of the Northeast.
And what are you doing now?
Well, now I write for Ballet Review, which is a dance publication in New York that's been around for a long, long time. And that keeps me connected to the ballet world. So I cover Miami City Ballet as a critic. And I interview dancers in my field and choreographers and directors. But to make a living, I'm a massage therapist.
And how do you like it?
I really like it. Yeah, it's great work for me. It keeps me connected to the human body, which is something I've kind of spent my life exploring.
But Michael, do you miss dancing?
That's a difficult question. I don't miss dancing.
Why not?
Well, because there was so much pain involved and so much suffering involved in it for me. A lot of pleasure, a lot of joy. I miss the community of dancers. There's a certain understanding that we all have that you don't find. I mean, I suppose you find it in normal life, you know, with any group of people that are sort of intensely driven and work together. You know, people that work in film or musicians, for example, they speak a language that is kind of unspoken. And I do miss that.
We've been talking to Michael Langlois about his memoir, which is required reading for anyone who loves ballet. And even if you know precious little about it, it's a no-holds-barred look at what goes on in those rehearsal studios. It's titled B+, Dancing for Mikhail Baryshnikov at American Ballet Theatre. Michael will be sharing stories from it at Books and Books in Coral Gables this Thursday.
And you can find more information about Michael's book and details for the event at Books and Books in Coconut Grove by going to our website, WLRN.org. Well, that's Sundial for this Wednesday, January 23rd. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.